Thanks for having me. And what I would like to talk about is, of course, asymptotic safety and how to compute asymptotically safe correlation functions and then to extract physics from them. And great. So the talk is a bit divided into parts. So I want to explain what asymptotic safety is, how to compute asymptotically safe correlation functions, and I also would like to do some remarks on unitarity, which I think are important in order to understand how we then construct correlation function observables. Okay, and then there are two applications, and they will be then relatively brief. I will recall results discussed in the first part of the talk. So I will start with explaining something about asymptotic safety. Of course, it's a bit like carrying coals to Newcastle to talk about this at the PI. But Luca told me, okay, everybody's interested in gravity, but not everybody knows what asymptotic safety is. So for those of you who know, please be patient. So we start with the Einstein-Hilbert action. And the first thing, of course, you would do is to do perturbation theory. But now, I mean, gravity is perturbatively non-renormalizable, and you essentially can already see this by looking at the dimension of the Newton constant, which is minus two, which usually is not good if you want to do perturbation theory. And then if you embark on it, because you say, okay, that's the first thing which comes to mind. Yes, it looks not renormalizable. Let's test whether that's really true. Failure starts at least at two loop to happen. So we have to do something else. If we want to look at quantum gravity as a quantum field theory, and what comes to mind, of course, is that we just look at non-perturbative setup, but still in quantum field theory. So at the very end, what we want to do, it's like in perturbative quantum field theory or perturbative gravity, which of course you can use below the Planck scale, we are interested in correlation functions. And of course, because we have a diffeomorphism invariant theory, we would be most interested in correlation functions of diffeomorphism invariant objects, like the Ricci scalar. But the first thing we have, in particular in a perturbative setup, are correlation functions of the metric. And at the very end, we will also use these correlation functions of the metric in our non-perturbative setup. Okay, so how do we come to an asymptotically safe theory? So I will just look at the analog between computing something in perturbation theory and computing something in a non-perturbative setup where the only thing we take into account is a non-perturbative fixed point. So standard perturbation theory just means I expand an observable in terms of orders of the coupling. So OG is some observable I pick, and I expand it in the tree level part, one loop term, two loop term, and so on. But at the very end, it's just a power series in the coupling. I could even shift the point I expand about instead of expanding about coupling zero. So G here is the coupling. And you will realize that G, of course, is a multi-notation here. I mean, G is also the metric, and also other things are called G. It's a bit unfortunate, but I mean, that's how it is. So I could expand also about some specific coupling, which I call G star. And this could converge better than a series about the free theory, depending on what the structure of my theory is. And of course, I mean, G star, if I have a non-perturbative fixed point, so which we hope for in quantum gravity, it could be the fixed point coupling. That begs the question, what is a fixed point coupling? So if you look at renormalization group scalings, so we take a derivative of the coupling with respect to some momentum scale, which of course later will be the RG scale, but you can really see this in particular in the setup I want to talk about as a physical momentum scale. Then I have the beta function, for example, for the coupling of the theory, and I have a beta function for the mass parameter. So mu would be the mass parameter of the theory. And of course, this goes on to higher order couplings and so on. Fixed point is the point where these beta functions vanish. And what is very important here is that we look at scale invariant couplings, which means dimensionless objects. So if I have a dimensionful coupling, I have to multiply this coupling by scale to some appropriate power in order to get the beta function of an object which really can have a fixed point. So what do we have in QCD, for example? The beta function of the strong coupling is just the celebrated result, which even then was awarded a Nobel Prize, minus, so it's negative. Then there is some symmetry factor g to the power 3. And you instantly see, if I want to have a zero of this beta function, it is g is equal to zero. And that's actually the celebrated asymptotic freedom. And this stays if I go to higher orders in the coupling. Asymptotic freedom is around, and it's a physical property. Now, if I look at quantum gravity, the coupling I can look at is the Newton coupling times my momentum scale squared, so the renormalization group scale squared. And the same I have to do with the cosmological constant. I have to divide this by momentum scale squared. Now, if I look at the Newton, the dimensionless Newton constant, the beta function will have quantum parts. So this is the loop expansion, if you wish, if we do it perturbatively. And it has a dimensional part. This is this factor 2 here. So a fixed point now can be either G0, that would be the Gn is 0, that would be the perturbative fixed point, or it is the anomalous dimension is minus 2. And what we are interested in asymptotic safety, is this non-trivial fixed point where the anomalous dimension is minus 2. And the only thing this actually does is it reduces the theory to the critical dimension. Okay, so that's what we are now looking at. We are looking at this non-perturbative fixed point. That's the asymptotic safety program. Okay, so how do we compute now in the setup correlation functions? And if you look at asymptotic safety, if you wish, the functional renormalization group rules. So most of the computations are done with the functional renormalization group. And I've tried to keep this very non-technical. I have to explain, if you wish, a bit the master equation, but I hope I do it in terms of physics. So at the very end, we are talking about a functional, which is the generating functional of correlation functions. So the correlation functions of my metric field, which, however, we have to split into a background field, so a background metric, and a fluctuation field, which is actually then the field whose correlation functions are computed. We can also have meta fields, so it's a very general equation. And this generating functional, the effective action, is in a standard quantum field theory, it would be nothing but the free energy in the presence of general background configurations. And the scale derivative, so the RG scale derivative of the free energy, is just the bunch of one loop terms. So I have not left out higher loop terms. These are one loop terms. But this, for example, would be gauge fields. And this object here would be the full momentum and field dependent two-point function of a gauge field. This would be the full momentum and field dependent two-point correlation function of the fermions, the bosons, the graviton. And these two terms here, so the two dash terms here, are gauge fixing ghosts. So what we are talking about here is a gauge fix setup. That's the thing we need. This formalism can only be formulated in terms of a gauge fixed theory, because we need the two-point correlation functions of our fields. And this dash cross just stands for the fact that all these loops in momentum space are just regularized, and they are ultraviolet finite. So in one word, we have a flow equation for the free energy. And we can start at some point where we know the energy, for example, in the regime where gravity is classical. And then we go to, we flow just to the other momentum regimes. We need a background metric. And we are talking about fluctuation functions, a correlation functions of this fluctuation metric or fluctuation field, which we call H. Keep in mind, if we make this linear split, which is usually done, the field H is not a metric itself. It's a difference of metrics, so it's not a metric itself. So now we can do the same, if you wish, as in perturbation theory. We make an expansion in powers of the fields. So the full effective action is given by an effective action which only depends on the background metric. And this object here actually is diffeomorphism invariant. While now the correlation functions, which are the coefficients in an expansion in H, are not diffeomorphism invariant. They are also not diffeomorphism covariant. So that one has to keep in mind. So in a way, this would be an object we would like. This is a free energy formulated in a diffeomorphism invariant way. But what we have to compute in order to get this is this full series here, because it's this object here which goes back into the loops. Okay, so this leaves us with the following thing. We have diffeomorphism covariant correlation functions here. These are the correlation functions of the background metric, which we get from a diffeomorphism non-invariant expansion. Okay, so these objects here on top of this are also gauge independent, while these objects here depend on the gauge. So it's a very interesting and subtle interrelation. At the very end, we get something which is gauge independent, but we expand it in terms of gauge dependent objects. Okay, so at the very end, we are interested in the red object, but we have to compute the blue one. So once again, we now look at these two effective actions, the one with the fluctuation field and the one with the background effective action, which is more related to physics, in terms of expansions. And now in the expansion we have in the fluctuation field effective action, we still have invariance, because if you look at BST invariance in quantum gravity, if you look at terms which are only depending on the metric, they have to be diffeomorphism invariant. Okay, so there is a diffeomorphism invariant part even in the fluctuation field effective action, but you have the full diffeomorphism invariance and gauge independence in this background effective action. But I say again, which is very important, this can only be, so the background effective action can only be computed from fluctuation field effective action, which is background, which is gauge dependent. So this is a complicated program, how to get the physically effective action, which is both gauge independent and background independent, and of course diffeomorphism invariant. Okay, however, since we already have these objects here, maybe we can use them and relate them to the similar objects in this background field effective action. And the question is, how much do they differ? So how much do the gauge dependent objects differ from the gauge covariant objects? And for that, actually, it is interesting, and that's my short deviation to unitarity, to look at the spectral representation of correlation functions. And if I have the graviton propagator, or here the example would be a scalar field propagator, in the Euclidean domain, so for imaginary time, it may have a spectral representation. And the spectral function in general is defined as the expectation value of the commutator of two fields, While there's also a statistical function, which is the anti-commutator, but let's concentrate on this object here. I can always define this, but only in case I have such a Kellen-Lehmann spectral representation, this identity here holds, right? So both the Euclidean propagator exists, always exists, and also the spectral function always exists, but this relation does not always hold. If it holds, it's pitch perfect and simplifies a lot of computations as well as unitarity relations. Okay, so how do we get this object? So usually quite some of the computations in asymptotic safety are in the Euclidean domain, because if you look at the loop equations we finally have to solve, and we have to solve them numerically, they are very complicated to solve in Minkowski space. So what you could do is you take this propagator in Euclidean space and you reconstruct the spectral function. This is an inverse integral transform. It's an inverse problem and a really hard one. So we have studied this, but of course, it would be far better to do a direct Lorentzian computation in asymptotic safety. And this means you have to discuss regularizations, so infrared cutoffs in asymptotic safety, which in the best of all worlds would have these three properties. Of course, they would not destroy Lorentz invariance, so they would keep Lorentz invariance, or actually diffeomorphism invariance. They would get finiteness, and they would not spoil causality of the whole construction. We have baptized this at some point the unholy trinity, because it's very difficult to find a cutoff which has all three of these properties. If you want to construct them, you have no chance. You can at best have two of these properties. And we, because we are talking about quantum gravity, decided it would be best to have Lorentz invariance and causality and do something a bit more hands-on, if you wish, about the finiteness. So if you take all these constraints together and you don't care about finiteness, if you wish, you end up with the Kellen-Simancic regulator, which is a regulator which essentially introduces really a mass term into your theory. Usually then finiteness is lost. You have to additionally regularize your loop integrals. We have studied this conceptually, and we have found that we can define this in a very finite, manifestly finite way in a specific limit of standard RG equations. So I don't want to go into the technical details here. So now we can compare the fluctuation spectral function, which is the spectral function which gives you the two-point function of the fluctuating graviton. And you can compare this with the spectral function of the background graviton. One, we did within a direct computation. So this is now using this Lorentzian FRG setup. This is a paper by Yannick Fehre. It was the PhD, the master thesis of Yannick, and together with Daniel Littim and Manuel Reichert, when we were both in Sussex. And we also did a reconstruction. So this inverse integral transform together with Alfio Bonanno and Tobias Denz. So Tobias was a PhD student in my group who did the work here. And again, Manuel Reichert, who was also co-supervising Tobias. Okay, now if you see the two spectral functions, they are very different. First of all, the spectral function of the fluctuating graviton is positive. It's pretty trivial in the infrared. So below the Planck scale, it has a peak at zero, so a delta function at zero, and then it has a scattering tail, if you wish. And of course, in the ultraviolet, it reflects the fixed point running of quantum gravity. The background spectral function has a peak, again, at about the Planck scale. So the Planck scale is here, but I mean, so that's still in the regime, but it is also negative. So it has negative parts. It has a negative part in the ultraviolet, a above the Planck scale, and it has a negative part in the infrared below the Planck scale. And both these properties, the negative parts in the ultraviolet and in the infrared, they have nothing to do with approximations. These are actually hardwired property you can prove conceptually. So there's nothing wrong here. That's what comes out. So the background graviton, and the graviton, keep in mind, is not a physical mode, has the spectral properties of an unphysical mode. Indeed, the spectral total spectral weight of the graviton spectral function is zero. This is a property it shares with the gluon, by the way, so there's nothing fancy about it, if you wish. While the spectral properties of the fluctuating graviton resembles that, oh, again, went away, resembles that of an asymptotic field. So this is that of an asymptotic state. It's positive, as a spectral function has to be, because it's, I mean, it's a probability, has a probability interpretation. However, it's not normalized. It's actually normalized to infinity. And that comes from the behavior here in the ultraviolet, because the eta h here is actually larger than zero. Okay, so the two spectral functions are qualitatively different, and that has nothing to do with approximations we did. This is actually how it comes out. So how much do they differ? They differ a lot. Okay, so I told you now already that the spectral function of the graviton and both of the background graviton and the fluctuating graviton tell you that in gravity, as in other gauge theories, and in particular in those with nonlinear symmetries, we have to deal with the fact that our gauge particles and essentially all the other gauge fields and all the other fields are not asymptotic states. So we have to do something in order to compute or define even observables, which tell us something about the theory in terms of physical states. And the first thing we actually did, and this is also how we got the background graviton propagator in the first place, you could look at scattering amplitudes. So here we looked at the scattering amplitude of two gravitons, which is not a physical object. But I mean, later on, this is still unpublished. We also looked at scattering amplitudes of, for example, E plus E minus scattering to mu plus mu minus scattering, which of course is a physical object. So now, how do you compute something like this? This object here, it depends on the graviton three-point function, which is this here. So it's a scattering of three fluctuation gravitons. It depends on the fluctuating graviton propagator. So there the spectral function comes into play. And then again, a three-point function of the graviton. Now, this object here, all vertices defined like this, of course, are not even RG invariant. And the RG invariant is defined the following way. You have a vertex, and you divide it by the wave functions to the one-half of the attached fields. And that is a definition you already do in standard particle physics theories. So that defines a renormalization group invariant vertex. In this case here, of course, it does not define diffeomism invariant amplitude, because we're talking about graviton-graviton scattering, which is not a physical process. However, that is setting the stage for computing actually scattering amplitudes. So essentially what you're doing is you need the vertices, you need the propagators, and you need a definition of the asymptotic states here, which you can all get from computing correlation functions in your theory. So that's the same as what you do in a standard quantum field theory. Okay. Now, I will leave this a bit out. And the last, if you wish, introductory remark concerns the physics of thresholds. And this has been both discussed in this community report, Alfio Bonanno and essentially quite some of the people involved in asymptotic safety wrote a community report where we stand and what are open questions. And you find also discussions in a review by Manuel Reichert and myself in the Frontiers of Physics. And there's also contribution to the handbook of quantum gravity, which is in process at the moment. So I hope it will come out soon. If you look at flows with this cutoff scale, there is a difference to standard RG schemes that these are physical momentum flows. So you really flow with the physical momentum scales and you see all the thresholds popping up. And what I have, what I'm showing here are already flows in the standard model, which I will discuss also later again. And you see how the flows for masses in the standard model, that's flows in the asymptotically safe standard model, actually freeze out below the threshold of the respective particle. Okay, so you have cutoff or momentum mirrors of the physical thresholds. And since this is sometimes called a bug of the asymptotic safety or the renormalization or the functional renormalization group flows, it's actually a feature, it's not a bug, right? The cutoffs, I mean, the thresholds should be in your flow because you're integrating out degrees of freedom and below the thresholds of a field, nothing is to be integrated out anymore. Okay. However, that's also something one should be aware of. If you introduce a cutoff in your theory in order to integrate out momentum modes, physics is only there at cutoff is zero and keeping the full momentum dependence. Okay, so it's all a bit complicated. Again, you can already see physical thresholds during the flow, but you have to go to cutoff is zero and then look at the full momentum dependence of the correlation functions in order to see the full physics. So this is something we have used now a lot in the standard model and in QCD, even more so, where we have also non-trivial effects. I mean, we have dynamical chiral symmetry breaking and confinement, so we understand this very well. Okay, so last technical remark, maybe. So we have to solve flow equations for correlation functions. And these correlation functions are just derivatives of the effective action. For example, I can take a flow for the effective action itself, maybe evaluate it on a specific background. This gives me the full potential of this theory. I can evaluate the flow of the one-point function, two-point function, three-point function, and so on. Okay? And as you can see here from the diagrams, if I want to compute the flow of the three-point function, I need the four-point function, the three-point function, and the five-point function, which means I have to at least compute the flow of the four-point function, which, however, has quite some diagrams. And the highest order one, if you wish, is the tadpole diagram. It's always the tadpole diagram here. And it has a loop and the external legs. So if I'm talking about the four-point function, I need the six-point function, and so on. So the hierarchy of these flow equations is coupled, and it always couples to the correlation functions with two fields more. That's the highest order here. I have not left out higher order diagrams. It's a one loop exact equation. But I mean, one loop does not mean too much here because these are full correlation functions. So it's not perturbative one loop. So this line here is a full propagator. This vertex here is a full propagator. So these are fully non-perturbative equations. So the resummations, if you want to get back to perturbation theory, all orders of perturbation theories come from this feedback from the higher order equations into the lower order equations. So if you want to get out perturbation theory, you just iterate this equation and you get it. Okay, so now, since we are in a non-perturbative setup and we have a non-perturbative theory, how do we see that, I mean, we are getting sensible results? And the only convergence property we have here is what we call apparent convergence. So what we are doing is we are going from this lowest order to the higher orders, and look at whether the results for correlation functions converge by going from the low order truncation in a vertex expansion to the high order. So, for example, the background approximation, which is quite often used in the field, and which has been used in the first seminal paper of Martin Reuter in 96, is just about solving this equation here. Okay. You go to the one loop function, so you feedback the one loop function into this equation here. This has been done with a bimetric approach by Martin Frank and a PhD student of Martin at the time in 2011. You can go on, include the two-point function. So I'm talking here about the two-point function of the fluctuation field, and of course you need also the ghost. You can go to the three-point function, to the four-point function. And so far, nobody has gone to the five-point function and six-point function. And one of the reasons is if you look at this diagram, for example, here, and you trace it and look at the different tensor structures, it has 10 to the 27 terms. So you can imagine that if you go to higher orders, it's not getting better. Okay, so however, already in this system here, we see apparent convergence. I would say signatures of co apparent convergence. Of course, we are not fully converged yet. And we also did not take into account all tensor structures in the different vertices which float around here. For example, in the graviton three-point functions, you have to take into account over 30 tensor structures. So you can imagine that technically this is quite involved. Okay, however, what we can compute are momentum-dependent vertices. So the vertices we are talking about here have a momentum dependence. So we make an expansion about the flat background, and we take into account a symmetric point momentum dependence, and that is what you see here. For example, this is the flow, but we have also integrated this out of the momentum-dependent three-point function. And this is the flow of the momentum-dependent four-point function. And interestingly, if you normalize this to this RG-invariant vertices I have shown you, this is quite nicely approximated by a p squared and p to the power 4 term. And the three-point vertex is quite nicely approximated, at least for small momenta lower than the cutoff scale, by just p squared. And that already hints at the fact that there are specific tensor structures or curvature invariants which feed into these vertices, and other curvature invariants do not feed into these vertices. And I will come back to this later. I will not discuss the right-hand side, which involves tuning, actually, the Slavnov-Taylor identities you have to take into account in a gauge-fixed approach. Okay. So, as I said, not all tensor structures are generated. For example, that this is a p squared dependence and pretty accurately tells that there's no arm u nu squared tensor structure which is generated. While for the four-point vertex, we see that an r squared tensor structure is generated and an r tensor structure is sustained. Okay, again, this is now looking at the flow, but of course you have to integrate out these flows momentum in a momentum-dependent way in order to get your three and four-point functions at cutoff is zero. So we remove the cutoff. We are looking at the fully momentum-dependent vertices. Okay, now a last remark on apparent convergence, because this is very important. It's the systematic error control we have. So I told you we are doing an expansion in higher order vertices, if you wish, and at some point we call it a day. So at the moment we call it a day with a four-point function, even though we have non-trivial five and six-point functions around, but they are restricted by symmetry arguments. So such an expansion you can show works if the couplings stay finite, because you have a combinatorial suppression of diagrams with higher order vertices. So these tadpole diagrams all do not really feed back that much if their coupling is small to the flow equations. This comes from a phase-based suppression. Essentially, very heuristically, you can say that if you have a process, all these vertices are local in position and momentum space. So what you're talking about is a scattering, for example, of four gravitons or six gravitons, essentially at the same point. And these processes are very highly suppressed because the six gravitons have to meet at this point. And this is a very sufficient suppression. We not only see them in this suppression in gravity, we see them also in standard quantum field theories like QCD, standard model. So if you wish, we know what we are talking about here. However, it does not always work. If the couplings diverge, of course, I mean, this combinatorial and phase-based suppression is not working. And this, in some sense, you only have if you have resonant interaction channels. For example, in QCD, you have this, because if you have four, for example, four quark scatterings, you have to take into account mesons, diquarks. You have also blue balls if you go to the complex, so real frequency space and so on. But you can take this into account with the formalism of emergent composites. So you can take into account dynamically generated degrees of freedom within the flow equation. Okay, so these resonant interaction channels in gravity would introduce something like graviballs. And I don't really believe in them. So I think we are safe on this side. Okay, and keep in mind, it's a bit an oversimplification for the sake of the talk. But if you don't have resonant interactions, and you see them actually popping up if they are generated in the flow. So the flow equation in terms of resonant interactions, if you have a momentum-dependent approximation, shows its failure if you try to stay away from these resonant interaction channels if they are around. Okay, so now I come to the applications. The first one is some recent work of Alvaro Pastor Gutierrez and Manuel Reichert. And what we did there is we extended, of course, existing works, as you can see. So I only mentioned some of them. And there's a very nice status report. I hope it's still true. It's the latest one by Mark Schiffer and Astrid Eichhorn, which is also to be published in the Handbook of Quantum Gravity. But I think, I mean, Mark can tell you more, but I have not seen it's not published yet, even though it's now, well, 1 year on the archive. So it's slow. What we did there is essentially for the first time, we just took all the flows, the functional renormalization group flows of the couplings. We also introduced or included chiral symmetry breaking in the infrared, as well as confinement. So we really run our theory from the asymptotically safe fixed point in the ultraviolet to cutoff is zero in the infrared, including chiral symmetry breaking and confinement. And now you again see the flows. So what do you see here? You see the flows of the gauge couplings, so the electroweak couplings and the strong coupling, and the Higgs, the top Higgs coupling, and the self-interaction coupling of the Higgs. You see how they are essentially going to zero in the ultraviolet, so at the asymptotically safe fixed point. It's still an interacting fixed point, and how they essentially below the Planck scale jump on and finally settle in the infrared sector of the theory. Okay, and the flow we have tuned here is this, the one which flows into the standard model in the infrared. Okay, one of the other new things we added is that instead of taking the Euclidean top mass, we computed also the pole mass of the top, which is not the same as the Euclidean curvature mass you can extract directly from the flow equations in Euclidean space. So if you really want to flow into the standard model in the infrared, you have to tune your Euclidean mass to this value here in order to get the experimentally measured top mass of 172 GeV. Okay, and the prediction then is the decay width of the top, which actually fits nicely to the experimental value. So this is just picking out one of the observables we looked at, and I think it's actually the most important one because the difference between the pole mass of the top and the curvature, so-called curvature mass of the top, which is the Euclidean mass, is sizable. And this, of course, has consequences for looking at the stability of the theory in the ultraviolet. The other thing which was surprising for us, but now we also understand it a bit better, is that in the ultraviolet, the Higgs potential actually gets flat. So we made a Taylor expansion, we saw convergence, we also looked at the global properties of the fixed point equations, and you can see how the potential actually of the Higgs is getting flatter and more flat and more flat if you add more powers of the Higgs coupling. So this is essentially the power of the Higgs squared, which goes into the potential. Okay, so this led us to the surprising result for us that the asymptotically safe standard model in our approximation, keep this in mind, I mean, we are far from being fully converged here, is in a regime where the Higgs potential is completely flat, but you have two relevant directions. Then there is an instable area. So this diagram here shows the mass parameter of the graviton and the fixed point coupling of the Newton fixed point coupling. And there's an instable regime here. There is the regime we are in with the standard model, at least in our approximation. And then there's a funny regime. This lime color regime here is stable, but the Higgs potential has no relevant direction. So in the green regime, we have two relevant directions, so as many relevant directions as the standard model. In this lime color regime, no relevant direction, and in the red regime, it's unstable. So, I mean, then the theory would globally not exist. And also, if you look at the top and Higgs mass, so we are here in the stable regime, you see we are quite close to the unstable regime. We believe within the approximation we have, that's our error bands, but of course you have to take into account that in order to really be apparently converged, we have to do more. Okay, and in the last 5 minutes, I would also like to tell a bit about, I would say, first step in the direction of asymptotically black holes. So again, there I would like to point at nice reviews on black holes in asymptotically safe gravity. There's a nice review by Alessia, also from September last year, and there is also a review by Aaron Held and Astrid Eichhorn from 1 year ago, which also consider black holes beyond asymptotic safety. So what Jan Trenkle, who was a master's student in my group, and I did, is the first thing we did is we wanted to compute asymptotic black hole from looking at the quantum Einstein equation. And for that, of course, you need the effective action. So now we are coming back to what I have told in the beginning. This is the background effective action. And we look at an expansion in terms of curvatures where we take the full a dispersion into account in terms, of course, of the D'Alembert operator. So How do we do this? What we have computed are the gauge-dependent correlation functions. We can map them to RG-invariant couplings. And then, of course, we can now compute gauge-independent operators here in the expansion of the effective action. So these are the steps we have to go. We need this. This is a step within the computation of the fluctuation, the correlation functions. And if we have the fluctuation correlation functions here, we can compute the gauge independent ingredients in the background effective action. So we compute them in momentum space. So if you wish, there is some unfolding going on. It's again an inverse problem. We have to go from these objects here to this object here. And I mean, this is a bit, if you call it an internal joke. Of course, unfolding always means you're immediately looking at machine learning. But actually what we are doing is just an educated guess. So I don't want to cheat you by saying we have some machine learning architecture here for doing our job. We just have an educated guess. So essentially what we are doing is we constrain these gauge independent correlation functions by the gauge variant ones. And if you do this, so the details you can find in the respective paper, the form factors we get out for the FR squared and the F mu squared. So these are the full D'Alembert dependent form factors here in the RR potential, in the R mu potential. They are just looking like this. Okay, so what I'm plotting here is the momentum dependent ones, which you get if you just look at the F of R of D'Alembert or Laplace Beltrami and you go to a flat background. Okay, so with this in mind, we can now look at asymptotically black holes. The important point here is that we are not doing a cutoff identification with our scales. This is computing at cutoff is zero, so where the physics is, or reconstructing the full effective action in terms of form factors. So we have fully momentum dependent form factors at cutoff is zero. However, for the first steps in asymptotically black holes, we did a very minimal approach and we went beyond R squared black holes and took into account the next order terms here. So if you wish, this is the new thing. So it's not R squared black holes, but we took into account the first terms which come in the infrared from the expansion of these two momentum dependent correlation form factors. Okay, so the C1 and C2 are expansion coefficients in the form factors. So we looked at spherically symmetric solutions, looked at the weak field limit, got inspired, of course, the form here comes from looking at R squared black holes. So there are more parameters which we just set to zero. And I mean, this was also because lack of time. I mean, Jan had 1 year to do all the work. He had also to compute the correlation functions. So I was very much impressed, actually. And these are the numerical solutions that we get out. We compare them with standard Schwarzschild solution, and you see that even for, I mean, if you go close enough to the Planck scale, you see, depending on the parameters we put in, significant differences. And actually, we could essentially give a phase structure of these asymptotically black holes, only computed from going from the far outside regime close to the horizon by taking only into account the first coefficient beyond R squared black holes. We saw an interesting phase structure. However, I mean, one has to look whether there's anything here which finally, if the data are flowing in about black holes, can be measured. Okay, so I come to my summary. I hope I have, so I try to be as non-technical as possible. I hope I have convinced you that computing correlation functions in asymptotic safety is on a pretty mature level. We already begin to see a con I mean, apparent convergence. If you really go for it, it's technically quite challenging. And I gave you two applications where both of them, if you wish, require some upgrade, which hopefully will come soon. But we see already quite interesting results about the stability of the asymptotically safe standard model and potentially interesting phase structure of quantum black holes. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jan, for the very nice talk. So, questions in the audience here, maybe we can start.
If not from the others, I can ask one. Jan, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, so regarding the quantum black holes and regarding the upgrades of your computation, do you think it would be possible in the coming years to do the computation at R-cube level? Because from R-cube on, singularities should be resolved. And therefore, it would be nice to look at the black holes from effective actions at least cubic order.
I think it would be possible, but I mean, as you know, this is numerically quite challenging, and already in this very restrictive way here, we struggled. Well, actually, Jan struggled a lot, but I know that, and of course, as you know, in 1 year, there's not that much possible, and that would be something also where it would be nice to work with experts, right?
Okay.
Oh, I mean, this is the question of having the right code for this. So, straight answer, yes. And we are actually considering collaborations also with Astrid, for example, in this direction. But of course, the real numerical experts should be involved.
Okay.
Right. I mean, that was also the reason why we didn't go for more than, if you wish, momentum squared. So these two terms.
In principle, there is also another action range that if one uses curves or expansion, then in principle we can only trust the result asymptotically, right? As we go closer and closer to the place where there would be singularity, we would need all the curves or invariants in order to say something, right? And then it is all
Oh,
about corrections to.
absolutely. But you see, I mean, there are two things. I mean, we are talking about, are we talking about UV? So you need higher order curvature invariance because the curvature is getting strong, but you also need full spectral dependencies here. So if you want to have the full statement, I mean, I won't fully trust results which don't have form factors here and stop at R squared or R cubed. Right, but then one should be modest and go step by step. So as you said, I mean the R cubed, and maybe because I think this actually can be taken. I mean the full form factors I think can be taken into account. That's more a numerical stability problem, which I
Yeah.
think can be solved.
Thanks.
Okay, other questions online? And then I have a very naive question, perhaps. So, how do you see black hole thermodynamics in asymptotic safety? You mentioned black hole evaporation, and I was very intrigued, and I'm definitely not an expert in that topic from the asymptotic safety perspective. So what's the clearest way to see, should I expect quantum correction to the thermodynamics due to S0 and S2 appearing there?
Oh, yes. Yes, there are.
And do you see logarithmic dependence on the temperature, features like that appearing?
Well, we have not really studied this in great detail, but I mean, as I said, this is a very hands-on procedure here. But what you usually see in, I mean, so that's that. Now I'm reporting on also works of others. I mean, we have also a former work where we had this standard scale dependence identification. What you usually see are stable remnants of black holes. And you can see them by two things. You either have two horizons, which then stabilize the whole thing, or, I mean, the naive interpretation is that you have the black hole evaporation, but at some point your black hole, if you wish, enters the asymptotically safe regime, and then you're in a scaling regime and nothing happens anymore, if you wish, right? Both of these things have been seen, but so here we have not really, if you wish, studied this. Right. And in a way, here's one non-expert talking to the other one. So this was a preliminary study of black holes.
I see, because I was, maybe a follow-up then. I was curious, could, there's a raise then. So, but let me just finish, Nicola, my question, 1 second, and then I'll give you the floor. I'm sorry about it, but just very quickly, could a black hole be seen as a gravitable? Because you exclude those, you say you don't believe in those, right? And I was thinking about the fact that, you know, they could be macroscopic coherent state of gravitons in some descriptions. So do you think it cannot be?
I mean, it's not excluded, but as we see it, I mean, the gravity balls, if you wish, I refer to is really a resonant channel in a multi-graviton scattering. Okay, so that's the only, what you are talking about is if you look at the solution of the, call it quantum Einstein equations, do you see a coherent state?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm talking about is if you have a multi-graviton vertex, can there be a resonance, right? Which, I mean, in the infrared, this is very clear. So if you have a theory which has a infrared resonance, this is usually shown as a divergence at the resonant momentum in the scattering of the respective fields.
Yeah.
Okay. This we don't see here. Maybe an analog would be, first of all, it's in the ultraviolet, and there to see resonances or to have resonances is very difficult. And you could also say that the mass of this resonance is so big that if you are computing in the Euclidean domain, which we are doing, it's not really a resonance. So you have the same, if you wish, in QCD. You have loads of hadrons. They are all resonances, and they are even physical, right? But in the domain, they don't spoil the flow at all. The momentum dependent in the Euclidean domains does not feel any hadrons except the pion, because this is really quite massless. Okay, so yes, could be a coherent state, but there I have not that much to add. But no, in the flow, it won't spoil the party, if you wish.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Okay, Nicola, you have a question? You can unmute yourself.
Hi. So it's actually Hank. So thank you for the very nice talk. So my question is actually very much related to what Luca was just asking about. But I also understanding of a ball or one of these glue balls is a condensate. So from what I understand about, like, you know, theories in condensed matter, where they do very similar computations here, condensates will typically, if you have resonance and divergences because of that, usually the form factor and the vertices themselves, the vertex functions themselves, will receive like non-power series contributions. So like a log term or something. But here, the way that you're studying black holes here, right? Here you're assuming the form factors expand in power series and stuff like that, right? So I was just wondering, like, if you have anything to add about what you would expect if you add like a log term or something like that. Maybe that would make the analysis more robust.
I mean, we of course in the infrared, by the way, I mean the graviton has logarithmic terms. In the ultraviolet it has not, and the vertices are also, I mean, very smooth, and if you wish, very non-interesting. And in terms of this condensed matter analog, you have said is, I mean, I use the pion, but of course you can also go to a condensed matter system. And there, also there, if you go to imaginary time computations, these computations are only influenced by resonances and instabilities which are close to the Euclidean axis. And you also mentioned the glue balls. We actually have computed glue balls from the gluon four-point function, which itself is pretty boring, right? You hardly see anything, but you can compute the glue balls, which are then in the real-time domain. The mass of the glue ball is essentially 2 GeV, which is far away from the Euclidean axis, so it does not leave a sizable trace, even though it's, of course, around, in the Euclidean computations. Okay? So yes, I mean, I actually have done flow equations, so RG analysis of condensed matter systems. If you have resonances around, you have to heat them. Of course, you have singular vertex structures. We can take them into account in terms of these emergent composites. This is how it's done. And then these these resonance structures are just poles in your propagator, which can be treated very efficiently. Okay. And the real interesting thing is, if you take a momentum-dependent vertex and you insist of not introducing these composite fields, your vertex will show a singularity.
Yeah.
So you typically see that you fail, which is good. And here, at least in the approximation, we see no sign of something like this.
Okay.
All right. Other questions? Mark?
Yeah, I have a question about the Higgs potential that you showed. And it's just a confusion that I had also when looking at the paper. So if I remember correctly, the relevant directions that you have in the Higgs potential have largest overlap with the most canonically irrelevant operators, right? So, I mean, I'm still confused. So how can you actually, first of all, is that true? And then second, how sure are you that you then can see this fixed point in polynomial expansions?
So first of all, it's true, but it's irrelevant. So this overlap with the largest direction we got in a Taylor expansion, which, as you can already see also in the result, it gives you the full potential in a way, in a convergent way, but of course you have a convergence radius. So of course what we then did is, I mean, we also solved the respective differential equation is a differential equation of Sturm-Liouville type. And you can solve it, you can look at the eigendirections, and you can also see that now if you make an expansion of the full solutions, you get this wandering vector, but that's just an artifact of your approximation, I mean, of your expansion scheme. So
you're saying that the Sturm-Liouville problem gives you exactly this fixed point as an exact solution without having an expansion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, and you see also how the eigenperturbations behave. It does not mean, by the way, that this solves everything. So first of all, I really believe that this fixed point is around, but the real problem is you can see it a bit here. So if you look at the full global solution, there is a direction. I mean, it goes down. It's getting flat at the very end, right? But as an intermediate point, if you go a bit away from the fixed point, it's most likely that it looks like an unstable one. Okay, so you have a stable fixed point, but the question is, how can you approach the stable fixed point from the infrared? Okay, and this is an unsolved problem. So that's the real problem for me, and that's also, you know, that there's also this shift symmetric potential, which is very similar to that. And the problem is always how to approach this. And for that, you would have to solve a flow equation for the full potential and not just in a Taylor expansion. That's not enough. So that's my take on it. So I don't want to tell you, oh, everything is fine. So we have a stable fixed point with two directions, which means we have as many relevant parameters as in the standard model. We can flow from the ultraviolet to the infrared. We did this in the Taylor expansion. The global stability is still an unanswered question.
Thank you.
All right, so I suggest we thank Jan again.